WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We're devoting today's show to The Graduate, which has been re-released as a special 40th anniversary DVD. The screenplay for the 1967 film was written by Buck Henry, who adapted it from the novel of the same name. Henry co-wrote the TV spy spoof Get Smart with Mel Brooks, wrote the screenplays for Candy, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and used to be a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. Terry spoke with him at the Film Forum in Manhattan in 1997 after the 30th anniversary screening of The Graduate.
You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. Ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
Wait, no. I understand you asked Doris Day.
I didn't ask anybody, God knows.
She was approached.
But I think Larry and Mike asked Doris Day. I'm not sure. I think they did.
What about Ronald Reagan?
I don't know whether it ever got to him. And think how his life could have been made more meaningful.
That's right. Think how much different the country might have been.
There were a number of people. I know at one point Mike was thinking about Jeanne Moreau, which I think would have been wrong, although she would have been wonderful.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was... it's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. It was so interesting. So then we rationalized it. Because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long, we had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we thought, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same... Suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller, and this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's wonderful.
And nobody ever... there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah. And
now the funny thing is, like I read, she was in her 30s, I think about 36 when making the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, although he's playing 20 years old, was really 29. So that would mean their ages are what, 7 or 8 years apart, which I mean, lots of people have relationships with people 7 or 8 years apart. It's and
yeah, but you have to buy him as being 21.
As being younger, right? But did they have to do anything to make him look younger and her look older so that they'd seem far apart, even though they weren't really?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, Dustin. Well, you know, all male actors play younger than they are, inevitably. And I think Dustin is buyable as being 21. I was amazed when I found out he was 30. I had some experience of Dustin in the theater. He worked in a theater I was playing in the early 60s. And then in the mid 60s, I went to this performance of a Ronald Rabe play called Harry Noonan Knight, a really strange and interesting play, in which Dustin played, in which I saw this guy, I didn't recognize him, playing one of the three lead parts. He was playing a crippled German transvestite. And I, by the middle of the first act, I knew I was seeing a really weird theatrical thing because I realized that the producer had gone out and hired a crippled German transvestite to play this part. The accent was perfect. The limp was spectacular. And his transvestitism was completely convincing. So I'd seen Dustin do really amazing, at least one amazing piece of work, but I didn't know until I saw him do the test that he could do this too.
The most famous line in The Graduate is the line where one of the father's friends says, "I've just got one word for you, one word, plastics." That line struck a chord. I mean, it seemed to just kind of sum up everything that was false, you know, that people didn't want their lives, their futures to be part of.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. It doesn't, you wonder why it took me more than 10 seconds, if indeed it did. I worried about plastics for a while and even talked to Mike about, are we too old-fashioned with plastics, which was sort of a 50s, 60s way of complaining about society's falseness. But I couldn't ever think of anything that was as interesting or more interesting or anything that wasn't a better word for them to say. Plastics is such a nice word. And the guy was so good who did it. The best thing about that was a few years later, I was watching television and I saw the scene come up, the party scene, except the actor didn't quite look like Dustin and the actress sitting in the living room didn't quite look like Anne, but it was every shot all the way through plastics to the end of that piece and then same photography and then why not try the Peace Corps? And the Peace Corps had done an ad perfectly parodying the movie. I wish I had it. It was really a good piece of work.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me. Now,
they're two very different things, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
An uncomfortable segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross. He'll be back in the second half of the show as our salute to the graduate continues. Here's Buck Henry in a scene from the film, as Dustin Hoffman is checking into a hotel for his first rendezvous with Mrs. Robinson. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
And where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I mean, I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of The Graduate, now out in a newly reissued DVD, by listening back to interviews with some of the show's collaborators. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Graduate screenwriter Buck Henry. Terry spoke with Buck Henry 10 years ago at the Film Forum in Manhattan. She asked him about the powerful final scene in the film. After Dustin Hoffman's character Benjamin Braddock is seduced by Mrs. Robinson, he falls in love with her daughter, Elaine. But Elaine goes off to get married. At the end of the film, Benjamin barges into the wedding and runs off with Elaine. They make their getaway on a public bus. But after a few moments of triumph and exhilaration, they stare blankly into space.
In the end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop and this, like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, actually, no, I don't think we did test market it, but also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame, he's so odd looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous, you've got to
No, nobody ever said that. And also it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl and they've run away from the people that they're scared of, and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
Did you know what was your guess?
No, I didn't know.
Okay. Now, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot while working. He thought, well, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
Sounds of Silence. I think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track. And, you know, there was never anything that could replace it, finally. I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker. And, you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called, the Strawberries? Lemonhead, yeah. Well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross at the Film Forum in Manhattan.